Peter R. Bregan, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT, and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour.
Hello, my marvelous audience. As I'm so fond of saying, undoubtedly the most aware in the entire field of psychology, psychiatry, mental health, nursing, anthropology, sociology, anything to do with human nature, human services. This is a marvelous audience. And I just love hearing from you occasionally about, you know, just what the show means to you. Many regular listeners. It's really marvelous. Now, I've got a fun announcement, which is that I have a brand new website. We've completely redone the website, changed the method behind it, make it much more available. It's working faster. Looks a little more modern. And, for example, today I was able to go to media, go to radio show, and to find out that my guest, Melanie Sears, was last on the show on November 15th, 2010, because I could search her by subject on the show, and that leads then directly to the podcast. So I've got this whole new setup that works really good on just searching out subject matter, anything you want about the shows. It's a whole new thing. If my voice is a little strained, it's because I'm raising it in response to heavy construction work going on outside my window. They're tearing up the street and putting down a new street, and they just got into it a few minutes ago. But I think maybe you won't be hearing too much of it filtering through. Melanie, are you there?
Yes, Peter, I'm here. Thank you for having me on your show.
Oh, I'm so glad you're there. You sound very, very clear. Well, before introducing you further to Melanie, let me give you a little background on what's been on my mind that I realized that I hadn't had her on the show in several years. There's a lot going on in the world right now which makes a person think about nonviolent communication, about how can people communicate in an empathic and caring manner. I get involved in occasionally in lawsuits involving the police. Several years ago, where a policeman tried to negotiate with a very upset lady, and who had just been napping in her car, and then when the people knocked on her window, she seemed to be just not doing well, so they called the police, and the police tried to get her to respond, and when she woke up, she was just very, very frightened and wouldn't pull down her window. And the policemen who were there were doing a good job of just sort of waiting with her, and then along came the sergeant in charge, and he just barged in on the scene, and he broke the glass of the window opposite her and shot her with a taser and didn't knock her out or down. And she was still stuck in her seat there, and he reached in, and she, unbeknownst to them, had a knife, and she injured him very badly on his arm. And I took that case on the grounds that there was absolutely no reason with a person who was obviously confused and really delirious to intervene in that manner. And the police basically did not press the charges against her, which they initially thought they would. And now we have a great deal going on now with issues surrounding the police. I am personally not someone who gets into blaming the police a lot. I really think, though on occasion you can see I've actually testified against them or written a report in that case. I think the police, they just have their patients tested now all the time, and now they even have to walk around in considerable fear given what's going on in the country. So this, to me, is not about criticizing the police so much as looking at the overall issue of nonviolent communication. Many times when the police do end up taking deadly action, they're being bombarded with violent communication and having to make split-second decisions. So I don't want to get far into that arena. I think that from my viewpoint, I like to tell police officers when I meet them that I really appreciate the work they're doing under extreme circumstances nowadays. That's my own view. What we will have a lot of agreement on with my audience is the problem that we're going to address really fully today, which is the issue of nonviolent communication in the health field, and particularly in the psychiatric field. It's my own view that in that field, the professionals are often hardly restrained and too often turn to aggressive actions against people who don't have guns and wouldn't be afraid of their having guns. It's not the same situation that's being dealt with out in the stresses of the community. So I invited Melanie to come back on. Melanie is a trainer in nonviolent communication. She has been a trainer since 1991 with the Center for Nonviolent Communication. And she works in just many different arenas with this. She's worked as a nurse for many, many years and has recently retired from that. But a lot of her experience is in the nursing field, on hospital wards. She works with individuals, couples, businesses, hospitals, hospices, parents. Basically, the way she puts it is to incorporate self-awareness and empathy into their communications. She has a book which I like. I would recommend Humanizing Healthcare. And the subtitle is Creating Cultures of Compassion with Nonviolent Communication. And she has a workbook called Choose Your Words, Harnessing the Power of Compassionate Communication to Heal and Connect. Hi, Melanie. Welcome again to the show. I won't wait this long again.
Hi, Peter.
We can dive into this either by your talking about your own background or right into the idea of nonviolent communication. Would you like to tell us a little of your background first?
Yeah, I'll kind of talk about both of those. I was a nurse for 35 years, and the last 13 years I worked in psychiatric hospitals as an RN, and I've been a trainer with nonviolent communication for the last 25 years. So what I did as a nurse, I integrated the skills of nonviolent communication into what I was doing, and the units that I worked on in psychiatry just operated very differently from the principles of nonviolent communication. So I'll give you an example. So one unit I worked on, I had a 70-something-year-old lady who had dementia and was not responding to any kind of verbal commands or anything. So this poor lady spent a lot of time in restraints because that is one of the few tools that the psychiatric nurses had to deal with people's behavior at the time. So when I had her, I was kind of torn because I could see that you couldn't really talk to this lady using language, but I suspected that what her real need was, her underlying need, that she wanted love and caring. She responded really well when I touched her. And the problem was there was a rule on the unit that you weren't allowed to touch anyone. So being the radical person I am, I broke the rules. I sat down and I let her lay down in her head in my lap and I stroked her head. And she was just totally cooperative during that time and did not have to go on restraints on my shift, did not have to take extra medications. And I just, believe that if we can begin to meet the needs of patients, and then we would have to use a lot less medications to control their behavior.
Well, I think it's extraordinarily true. And just in differences between hospital wards that I've worked on, on some wards, aggression from patients was considered inevitable, and suicide attempts were considered inevitable. And on another ward I worked on, neither of those happened, and they were obviously considered to be inevitable. People showed much more respect and care for the people they were supposed to be taken care of. I think it's very dramatic, the differences in different settings.
Yeah, it makes a huge difference how you respond to people. You know, do you treat them with respect or do you make demands and threats? You know, I think when you treat patients with respect and empathy, they're much more likely to cooperate with you. And that has actually been proven. There's a study done by Donna Reamer at Mendota Medical Center on the on a unit that took the worst cases of psychiatric issues in several states. And she integrated nonviolent communication into her unit with the resulting the results were extraordinary. For one thing, people used to hate working on that unit, and they were always short-staffed. Pretty soon, people wanted to start working on that unit because it became a pleasant place to work. The violence dropped drastically. The days of sick leave from being assaulted by a patient totally went away. The number of hours in restraint and seclusion also went down drastically. The hospital saved a bunch of money because of those things. And the patients actually started to get better. And these were chronic patients that no one really could handle. So they started getting better and were released to less restrictive units. And so she has this documented. It shows up in my book, the results of that. And so it's just pretty obvious to me that when we treat people with kindness and with empathy and really focus on their needs and learn teach ourselves verbal de-escalation techniques, you know, it just creates a more peaceful, safer place for everyone to be.
I think what the two code words for this kind of communication is this de-escalation techniques and nonviolent communication. Does it have other rubrics, other headings?
It's used differently with every situation. Like when I work with couples, you know, part of it is kind of I talk about their current paradigm. So, for instance, the current paradigm that many people go into a relationship with is this. And this is something my mother taught me, too. And her paradigm was, you will intuit my needs and meet them without me having to ask and without me being aware of what my needs are. And if you don't, I'll punish you. So when they come to me, I teach them, well, really, what love is about is clearly expressing your feelings and needs and hearing the other person's feelings and needs and vice versa. But in order to do that, you need to have a vocabulary and have learned a language of feelings and needs, which is not very well taught in this culture. People tend to be disconnected from their feelings and confused about what their needs are and even have shame about what their needs are.
Oh, I like so much the way you think about this. I like that that way of thinking about it too. I don't usually put it quite like that, and I like the way you're putting it, that people don't have the language, they're ashamed of expressing their needs, and you teach people to express their needs and be empathic toward the needs of others. And then that is certainly what it is about. It's not a panacea, because very often people do have needs for power and other things that get in the way, I think. But the more well-meaning the people start out to be, the better it works. Do you have a more optimistic view than that?
I believe that even when people are trying to, I think everything a person does, they're trying to get a need met. So if you can look at it like that and understand that people are just trying to meet human needs, and some of them are going about it in ways that I may not enjoy, using strategies that are violent because they don't know how to express their needs directly. But nonviolent communication teaches us to tune into what the underlying needs are that may be expressed and to just verbalize what you're seeing. So, for instance, if someone has a need for power, you can say, I think it's a human need. We all need a certain kind of power in different ways. We try to get that need met. So you can say, you know, do you have a need? Do you want to be feel powerful? And the person can agree or disagree. But just by opening the dialogue and being honest about what feelings and needs you see that person demonstrating, it can bring the situation down and turn it into a dialogue instead of some kind of acting out.
I do think that's so true. It reminds me of what happens sometimes when I notice that I'm dealing with a couple and the woman is really afraid of the man and kind of looks at his hand to see if it's twitching when she says something. And I bring up, have you been threatening your wife? And it comes out that he has been. And I tell him, well, first, you're going to stop today. And starting today, you're going to learn how to actually get more than you ever imagined from your partner with a whole different set of approaches. And yes, it often does work to really help people see that there are ways to get their needs met, that really can enable them to give up being manipulative, bullying, threatening, and so on. I think that really is true, especially with folks who come for help, especially when people are coming for help. They'll often listen to that. Mm-hmm. And I also address it very directly with children when they're hitting each other and bullying each other. And I directly address that issue of what they can really get from each other and what it can really mean to have a loving relationship with a brother or a sister, and how that can fulfill really, really important needs, and how they can learn to do that and not intimidate and not hit and not go for power and so on. Do you work with kids much? Have you worked with children?
I've worked some with kids. You know, sometimes their parents will bring their kids in. Sometimes I'll meet with a person, and pretty soon I'm seeing their whole family. So, I like working with kids. And, you know, they really get what I'm talking about because it's really closer to their natural language, you know, feelings and needs. You know, kids express their feelings when they're born, and they kind of learn to hold it in. And I think our whole psychiatric system encourages that. You know, if somebody has a feeling that we're uncomfortable with, we give them medications to repress that feeling. And the more we repress the feelings, the sicker we become, in my opinion, because I think our feelings are part of our humanity. And I think it's very useful to learn a language where we can once again express those feelings in a self-responsible way.
I think that is so important. And one of the things I see is the therapists become afraid of their patients' feelings. It's understandable. Your patient comes in and you get a sense that they're feeling suicidal. Maybe they tell you they are, or that they're feeling very violent towards somebody. And it's easy to get scared. And if you're a non-medical therapist, to quickly refer them to the psychiatrist for medication, rather than treating the feelings by welcoming them. Well, tell me, what in the world makes you so angry right now at your wife or your kids or your husband? And why would you want to hurt yourself? And tell me the feelings. Feelings are good things to know. They tell us about ourselves. Let's get into them. Let's welcome them. And that is very different than almost anybody's getting nowadays from therapists, let alone from their husbands and wives, because the therapists panic and they feel they have a need to protect themselves.
Yeah.
And they've been told that drugs are the answer and drugs make things worse by putting people out of touch with their feelings and giving them bizarre feelings they can't even understand.
Yeah. The medications just tend to repress that. And, you know, the longer you're on those meds, it's part of the whole symptoms of the culture, is that we're taught to look outside of ourselves for answers. We're taught to give our power away to external authority. And the more we do that, the more habitual it becomes, I think the harder it is to find our to go back to our humanity and learn how to access our inner self so that we can really heal, because I believe healing is an inner job. And by looking outside ourselves for a quick fix like medications or ECT, you know, it prevents us from doing the deeper healing work that we need to do. And it's a product of our culture, so it's really hard to do that deeper healing work because we're socialized to give up our power to external authority instead of finding our own inner authority. Now, when I was working at my last psychiatric job, I did teach some nonviolent communication classes to the patients, and I had to be careful because what I was teaching directly went against what the unit wanted them to be learning. So I had one patient who was there for ECT, and the poor guy was just terrified about ECT. He didn't want ECT. He was scared about what it would do to his brain, but he says, I have no choice. The doctor says I have to have ECT, so I have no choice. So I worked with him for a while until he realized. I gave him empathy, and he really had a lot of emotions coming out. And toward the end of that time, we talked about choice and that when people do anything, they're doing it because there's some choice in it. They're trying to meet some need. And he kind of got that he did have a choice. He thought he had no choice because the external authority said, do this. But he began to find out that he had a choice inside himself to say no to that external authority and that the buck stopped with him. He needed to take care of himself. He needed to monitor his own self-interest.
I think that's a beautiful example. And I think that what we do run into when we're working on a hospital ward or in a clinic is that a lot of this kind of work then runs into difficulty with the prevailing ethos and communication skills of the people who are in charge, or just even your peers. And I know that it can be a hazard to do what you're describing doing, and which I also did. I behaved exactly like that, and when I was working, in a hospital as a psychiatric resident. What did you find working for years as a nurse when you were bringing in these better ideas than the environment was used to?
Well, I just wanted to mention, the next day that patient signed out AMA, and I was just hoping that he wouldn't mention, well, that nurse Mel, you know, she kind of made me see the light or whatever, you know. So it was like I was always working kind of against the system. I kind of felt like a spy in the system because my ideas about what is wellness and what is really helping people was so different than the mainstream paradigm.
I can't remember. Did you during the 13 years in psychiatry, were you entirely on the wards?
Yes, I was. I was working on two units during that time. Well, I have my coaching business also on the side, and I do work with businesses and hospitals to do some trainings.
I think, folks, it's so important to become more of an entrepreneur and more independent so that you do establish ties outside of clinics and hospitals that you may be making your basic income in. Because if you have other alternatives, at least you can look forward to developing them. And if it isn't going to work for you in the clinic, if it is compromising your ethics to be on the ward, and if you're not able to do the work that's helpful there, that you can begin to develop your own group. And I just hope more and more people are going to start banding together in their own independent groups, even if they're loose affiliations of nurse practitioners or clinical social workers or psychologists or psychiatrists, and develop their own groups in which they can support each other in their own kind of practice. I don't see a lot of that happening, but I think some of it's happening with non-medical people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's important that people learn how to begin to get their needs met because the rate of burnout is so high in those clinical situations, that it's really important to do something that feeds your soul, that that is really useful for you, that is in congruence with your internal values. So, which is why I had such a hard time working on the units, because my internal values were different than what was going on. I didn't like the amount of drugs that my patients were getting, and I was, like, really scared about ECT, you know, because I would have a patient come to one of my groups the night before getting ECT, and they were able to process, and they were able to understand what I was saying. And then they'd come to my group after receiving ECT, and they couldn't follow what I was saying. They couldn't process any of their own feelings, you know, and, you know, I know that there's a transition period, but it was just kind of scary for me to see the effect that that had on people's brains.
Yeah, you know, and it's violent communication. ECT is violent communication, and to a great extent, so is medication. It's very suppressive to offer someone a drug instead of encouraging them to have more of their feelings and manage their feelings and learn from their feelings. Feelings aren't the truth, from my viewpoint. Feelings are feelings, and we need to understand them, and we don't always want to obey them, and sometimes we do want to learn from them and take direction from them, but we have to, you know, we have to keep our own rational and cognitive abilities alive as our major guides, I think, ultimately. But it's very violent to be drugging millions of children and millions of adults in our cultures. It's most extraordinary, and it's against all that's really true and good about how to relate to people. It's hard to even find words. There's no way to exaggerate how bad it is out there due to this collaboration between psychiatry and the pharmaceutical industry, which has now led to everybody with a prescription pad prescribing these drugs. It's just terrible.
Yeah.
When did you first realize that medications were not the answer?
Well, when I started psychiatry, I really didn't know anything about it. And pretty early on in my psychiatric nursing career, I read your book, Toxic Psychiatry. And I took to it like a duck to water and read everything that you'd ever written. And, you know, it certainly helped, kind of helped me understand what I was seeing, and it helped me figure out what I would do differently. Because, you know, it started with me not liking what I was seeing, not feeling good in my body. I am in touch with my feelings, and I was scared a lot of times being in that unit. I was scared at their system. I was scared how judgmental they were toward the patients and toward each other. It was just a very violent unit. So your book really helped me understand what all was going on, and so for the next many years that I worked in psychiatry, I kind of followed that, your teachings, to a great extent.
How did you not get fired or brought up on charges or something?
Well, it was a little tricky. I mean, some of my bosses really didn't like me. They felt threatened by me. Part of it was I worked in one hospital where I could hide pretty easily. I could go into one of the charting rooms and spend a lot of time in there without people noticing. The last job, I was just more out in the open. But I did have a very supportive boss who liked me, who liked my book, who also had concerns about the psychiatric system. And she was the head person there. But she was tolerant, and she wanted me to teach nonviolent communication. But I had to be careful, because the psychiatrist, of course, had a whole different way of looking at treating mental illness than I did. So I didn't want the patients that I had done a group with and worked with to go in him and said, well, Mel says it's this way, you know, and or have a patient sign out AMA and say, because Mel told me, you know. So I kind of had to be careful about that. And I guess I managed it, because I did manage not to get fired. But I think it took a big toll on my psyche to work in that arena and just see what happened to people who rely on medications and ECT to get better. You know, it wasn't like they came in one time and took one pill. was like these patients kept coming back over and over again, taking stronger and stronger medications, getting more and more ECT, becoming more and more cognitively impaired, you know, and it was just really hard for me to watch that process because I'm very much a patient advocate. And yet I had to be careful about what I said.
You know, I'm so glad you're speaking so directly today. It really is bad out there, and this is getting so much more on my mind lately. I'm working on a new book, and I'm just constantly returning to the question, how do you explain to people who don't see what's going on what a dreadful scourge has descended upon the communities of the world with this implementation of what is essentially state mental hospital thinking upon the whole community. Mm-hmm. It's very hard to find words, and you're giving some good descriptions and explanations of it. And before we used to drug our patients so much earlier in my career, you didn't have patients coming back worse and worse and worse. What you would sometimes see is the patient would come back maybe every few years, and a lot of patients never came back. And in your private practice, you expected people to get well. You didn't expect them to get sicker. That was like, why would people get sicker if they're getting decent help? And often the help was, in the places where I'm talking about, it was very psychologically oriented. But I also watched over the transition where psychiatry completely gave up on psychotherapy because it couldn't make as much money doing it. And they couldn't compete with better trained psychologists and social workers and counselors and nurse practitioners and RNs and so on. So, I've lived to see the profession actually come to think that people get worse and you can't talk to them. They just get worse and worse, and you got to give them more and more toxic and damaging treatments. And it just is, it's actually the treatments that are doing it, and including the unloving lack of caring attitudes they have to deal with on the part of mental health professionals. It's really dismal, folks. And I hope not to cave you in, but to inspire you to really think that you can, like Melanie has been doing, carve out a place for yourself and then eventually leave the system. Are you happy to be out of the system, or do you miss it a little?
Oh, I haven't missed it a single day. I'm ecstatic to not have to go to work anymore. I enjoy my NDC practice, and I just have a lot of freedom and congruence in my life. So, you know, I have a lot more time to take care of my health and to, you know, pursue things that interest me. So, yeah, I haven't missed it. And I thought I would miss it because some of my needs did get met in that system just a little bit. But there are just so many better ways to get my needs met than to work for a system that I don't believe in.
Yeah. Well, I think there's more and more people are, well, more and more getting drugged due to the huge power of the propaganda machine. More and more people are also looking for alternatives. I mean, everything from physical alternatives like chiropractic and with the needles. I'm having word fine. Yes, what'd you say?
Acupuncture.
Yeah, with acupuncture. And massage, and then, of course, meditation and therapies of various kinds. I think that there's, on the positive side, there's a big and increasing world of that kind. And I heard you call yourself, I think, a trainer, right? Is that the word you were using?
Yeah, I'm a trainer, nonviolent communication.
And, you know, there's a lot of space for people becoming various kinds of trainers that where they're not subject to a lot of control. Now, is nonviolent training a licensed profession?
No, it's not licensed, but you have to go through a process to become a trainer. And you have to study with an assessor who's already a trainer and just go through a certain process to become a trainer in nonviolent communication.
Yeah, but it's a private kind of a thing where it's not the state that's then licensing you. And I think that's good. I think we need more and more alternatives that aren't licensed, because as soon as there's licensure and state control, there's power, and the whole issue becomes, you know, increasing my income and having more of a monopoly and requiring more years of training that ruin you as a provider of services. So I'm really encouraging people to just carve out their own niches out there and advertise them and do them. Experiment and explore with what you can contribute.
Nice. Well, you know, Nonviolent Communication is an international company. It's not really a company. It's a group of trainers, but they're trainers in every continent in the world, and we just got a new trainer in Africa. So it's a pretty vigorous thing that you have to go through to become a trainer, and you really, the hard part is really integrating the skills, because it can be difficult to integrate these skills, because we've been programmed in such violent ways in this culture. So to learn different skills and to be able to use them in difficult situations, you know, it takes a little bit of work. It takes some work. So I'm really grateful that it's an international, that it's international, and that there are trainers all over the world doing it, because it's kind of exciting to be in connection with people on the other side of the world from me, and who know the same principles. And I could call anyone who's a trainer if I was in need of some empathy, and they would know how to give me empathy. Now, that's kind of different than, I live in a co-housing community. It was a strategy to try to get my needs met for more connection. And one day I was upset, and I got everything but empathy that day. I got advice, I got judged, I got try to fix, I got reassured. And, you know, I could just see what happened in my body when people were doing those things when I was in the need of empathy. But I went home and I called somebody that I knew had empathy skills, and that person was able to give me empathy, and I felt better.
Yeah, it makes a huge, huge amount of sense. Now, your group, again, it gives its own certificate, right? It's like a certificate program where you then can call yourself a trainer in nonviolent communication. How exactly does it work?
What do you need to do to become a trainer?
Well, and then what do you get? You get a certificate that is trademarked.
Well, yeah, I mean, nonviolent communication is trademarked, and
what I'm trying to get at is how this develops, because it develops, I think, in a very good way, which is outside the system, and I think it's great it's trademarked, and I think it's great there's a certificate, but I just want to clarify how this evolves as a separate thing, because I think that's how the creativity has to come now.
Well, you know, Marshall Rosenberg created nonviolent communication many years ago. He studied under Carl Rogers. He was very much a humanistic psychologist, and he took information from a lot of different areas, and he put them together to form nonviolent communication. Plus, he studied people that were really good communicators, and he broke down what they were doing and into four steps. And these four steps are kind of like the foundation for nonviolent communication. So Marshall was a bit of a radical, and in his early days, he used nonviolent communication with migrant worker unions, with some schools, with various kind of organizations, and it wasn't wide known back then, you know, so he was barely scraping together a living. He had to drive a cab for a while because he wasn't making enough money, but before he did that, he was a psychologist, and he decided he wanted to quit being a psychologist because he didn't like charging people for his services and he didn't like writing reports, I think is one reason. So he kind of got out of the system himself. And he created this nonviolent communication because he saw the power that it had with people, and it was helpful. So early in his career, he was restricted from traveling because the government thought he was doing something, you know, that was a little bit, I don't know the word, but...
Subversive. Subversive. That's the word. Subversive. Was this the 50s that he was running into trouble?
It might have been in the 60s.
Really?
Yeah. It might have been in the 50s, but I think it was more likely in the early 60s.
Okay.
So eventually he traveled, and for many years his main place that he lived was Switzerland. And as he aged, he ended up moving back to the United States. He got married to a woman that lives in New Mexico, and that became his home base. But for many years, he lived outside of the United States because of the restrictions that and the things that he didn't like, you know, paying taxes and seeing those taxes used to support war and things like that.
Yeah.
So he definitely got out of the system himself and created this organization that has this international following and that is very helpful to people.
Now, does the organization itself integrate on some sort of theoretical level the issues from couples conflict to international conflict? Is that part of the goal or purpose?
Well, it depends on who the trainer is. As a trainer, you're not paid by the organization. You're really, you know, you're only paid with how, you know, with the work that you do and the work that you develop on your own. So some trainers are very interested in working in the political political realm. Some people are very interested in schools. Kind of my focus is on healthcare to a certain extent. You know, so everybody has different interests that they pursue on their own.
Do most people have another kind of degree that enables them to integrate this into it so they can make a living, eat more easily? Are most of them psychologists or nurses or social workers or administrators?
There's some who have degrees, but other people don't have any kind of degree, and they're just nonviolent communication trainers. And they set up workshops and... get people to come, and that's how they make their living with that. I don't think, you know, it's sometimes not, they don't make a whole lot of money, you know, but they're doing something that they love, so they justify it that way. I've known people, I had a friend who said, I don't have to worry at all. I make a good living doing NVC without any struggle. And when I heard him say that, I thought, oh, gosh, you know, I certainly don't do that. And he goes, yeah, you know, I make $8,000 a year. And I perked up and I go, well, I don't struggle for the first $8,000 a year I make either. You know, but he had figured out a way to live off of $8,000 a year comfortably, whereas I had not.
It's interesting. It sounds like the founder, you know, obviously came from a very political orientation, but it's not required or it's not a dogma of the organization from what you're saying.
Yeah, I believe that's true. You can use your skills in whatever area you want to use them in.
Yeah. It sounds like just very, very, a very good operation to me, and I just want to see more and more of it. I mean, I'd like to see people setting up training programs for people who want to call themselves therapists and don't have any training at all except what they're going to learn in the program. Don't have to go to high school or college. You learn it in the program. You're a decent human being. You can be supervised and learn to do some sort of a reasonable therapeutic approach with people. And when you're seeing couples, from what you described to me, you're communicating to them and helping them in very similar ways that I do when people come to me. Of course, they're coming to me as a psychiatrist and a psychotherapist, and they're coming to you as a nonviolent communications expert. Is that right?
Yeah.
And we're probably doing very similar things.
Yeah, mostly I help them learn how to hear each other. And some of them are very surprised at who they're married to, because they had an idea of who their spouse was, but they really hadn't sat down and really listened to what was underneath everything. So I give them the skills that they can use to listen to each other and to open up an honest and authentic dialogue with each other and how to resolve their conflicts.
Is couples work a big part of what you in particular do?
Lately, I've been getting quite a bit referrals for that. I like a lot working with couples because it's like you bring your own trigger to therapy with you. It's easier to find out what the triggers are and to be able to work through them. I like to work with live things that are live. You know, I don't like to have to dig them out. But I work with individuals also quite a bit. And last year, I worked with I went down to MD Anderson Cancer Institute for 2 days and did a 2-day workshop for the healthcare people at MD Anderson. And that was very well received and kind of exciting that people really embraced it.
I think it's very embraceable. I think it's wonderful. By the way, folks, time is zipping along. And it's 4:46 already, and I haven't even reminded folks we're listening to Melanie Sears. Melanie, your book, Humanizing Healthcare, what's the best way for people to get that? And the workbook, Choosing Your Words?
Well, Choose Your Words,
get
on Amazon. Yeah, Choose Your Words, it's self-published, but you can mostly find it on Amazon, probably other places too. And then Humanizing Healthcare, it sells at all the major booksellers. You can probably get a good deal on it at nonviolentcommunication.com. That's the publisher's website, and I think they sell it cheaper than Amazon. But anyway, it's only about $10, so it's not going to break the bank.
I noticed that Melanie is an RN, an MBA, and a PhD. What's your PhD in? Remind me of that.
It is it's on integrating nonviolent communication into healthcare.
So that was that a self-created PhD that where you went to an institution and said, I want to do this?
Yeah, basically, I went to International University for Professional Studies, and they let me design my own program.
Yeah.
I was so interested in the material, and I read many, many books about it and how the brain works and, you know, So I did it because I really enjoyed the topic and I wanted to learn more about it.
Well, you can call yourself Dr. Sears and nobody's going to know the difference.
That's
and
true.
That's, you know, to a great extent, the way it should be. You can't go to somebody for help and rely on their degree. You have to know the person. There's just no way around it, unfortunately. But when you have good certificate programs like the nonviolent communication group, at least you know they're coming from a certain perspective and have a certain degree of knowledge and understanding. By the way, folks, it's much too early for me to get specific, but I'm working on the possibility with a school on developing a training program. We're moving in that direction for the first time. Well, it would be a training program that grows out of my perspective. But it's not there that yet, so there's nothing for you to sign up for. But and I just hope other people will do the same things. Now, Melanie, do you ever work with individuals? I mean, it says you work with individuals. How do you work with an individual from your perspective?
Well, I mostly give empathy, but I also help them find solutions. Lately, it's interesting, things tend to come in waves. Lately, I had a couple of people come to me, and they were in the midst of a lawsuit. And what I did, I gave them empathy, what the feelings came up, and also helped them stay centered in dealing with what was going on. So instead of, you know, if they're, one of them was going through a divorce and her spouse was blaming her and throwing a lot of judgments at her, and she was, you know, it was scary for her. So I gave her empathy for the fear. And I helped her stay centered so that she didn't have to throw judgments back at him and it become a big fight. She just stayed clear about what she wanted, and she was able to negotiate that, and she got what she wanted out of the lawsuit. She didn't give in, and she didn't give up, and she didn't kind of lower herself to that, to mudslinging, and make it a really unpleasant experience for everyone involved. So both those people recently won their lawsuits, and I think it was to a large extent that they did the work they needed to do with them, you know, to navigate the system, to stay, to get the empathy they needed during that time. You know, so those, you know, that's an example of one thing I did with individuals. I have some clients all over the world, and some of them just call me for empathy. And all I do is hear what's going on inside of them, understand their feelings and needs. And by doing that, it makes them feel better. It helps empower them. It helps them accept their own feelings and needs. And it helps them be able to verbalize themselves in terms of feelings and needs instead of in terms of judgments or analysis or some of these other kinds of communication that we're taught to express ourselves in this culture. And the important things of being able to express ourselves in terms of feelings and needs is that feelings and needs are the universal human language. That's the area that makes us all human. We all have feelings and needs, no matter where you live. So if you can express yourself in that form, you're much more likely to be able to connect with people wherever you are than if you expect, like I was raised on the East Coast, and there's a certain kind of cultural way of communicating on the East Coast, much more judgmental and direct and, you know, but since I learned nonviolent communication, it's easier for me to fit into wherever I am, you know, and I don't bring my East Coast language to the West Coast because I notice people that do that, they're often not very popular because the West Coast has a slightly different culture than the East Coast. So it's tools that just help you fit in, teach you how to get your needs met wherever you are.
I think a lot of it has to do with a self-acceptance wherever you go, that you mm-hmm. accept yourself as you are, which then enables you to relax some and not have to insist that other people operate the same way you are.
Yeah.
Do you think in those terms as well?
Yeah, it's very important, the self-acceptance aspect. One thing I do with the tools is if somebody's expressing themselves to me in let's say a violent way, like maybe they're judging me, they say something like, "Melanie, you're so stupid," I don't have to take that personally. I can just hear that that person is expressing feelings and needs, and I can say something like, sounds like you're angry right now and need some understanding for what's going on with you. Maybe you're still a little bit hurt about what I said the other day. You know, let's talk about this. So speaking that kind of language really helps me stay well. You know, I'm not storing up misconceptions, assumptions about people. I can really check them out in the moment. I can hear past whatever language they're using and hearing that to their humanity. And that will create connections instead of creating enemies.
Yeah. Now, my wonderful listeners, most of you know this, but diagnosing people is the exact opposite of this. When you mm-hmm. diagnose people, you take a framework of your own, and it's a stereotyped, ugly framework as well, and you're imposing it on another person. And even if you don't tell them the diagnosis, which often we in psychiatry do tell people their diagnoses, even if you don't, they're going to get the feeling of being diagnosed. They're going to get the feeling at least of being distanced, of not being listened to, not being cared about, of not wanting to have an impact, to have some meaning in the eyes of the person who's trying to help them. Not saying that very artfully, but we all want to be taken seriously.
Yeah,
we all want to be taken seriously.
Yeah, I think that's very important. When we see a person through our own diagnoses or through our own judgment, people can sense it, and then of course they don't want to be open and honest with their feelings with us.
I don't know if folks can hear this. Maybe you can't hear it, but my room is shaking from major machinery working out front. But you're not hearing it, are you, Melanie?
Yes, I heard it just a minute ago.
Yeah, it's very much like being in a small earthquake. I've been in small earthquakes like that. Even got a few cracks in the wall over the last week. Very exciting, very exciting. Melanie, where do you work from? Tell people how they can get in touch with you.
Well, I work on Skype. I work out of my home. I have a home office. I'm in Seattle, Washington. And the best way to reach me is probably my email, which is awake, A-W-A-K-E, giraffe, G-I-R-A-F-F-E, at gmail.com. And I also have a website, which is dnadialogues.com.
As we get nearer the end, would you like to tell us the four principles of communication?
Oh, sure. The four steps in nonviolent communication?
Yes, yes.
Are you ready?
I'm ready.
The first step is the observation, making a clear observation without evaluation. And an observation is something a video camera can pick up. So this is, Krishnamurti said, one of the highest forms of human intelligence is the ability to observe without evaluating. So when something happens and that you feel upset about, you know, to communicate that using the first step of nonviolent communication, you would say something like, when I heard you say that, I was stupid. Okay. That's a clear observation. It was a direct quote, which is a clear observation. Now, if I had said, when you disrespected me, that would not be a clear observation. That would have evaluation in it. Disrespect is an evaluative term. So if you want clear communication, it's important to separate observation from evaluation. So that's a whole exercise in and of itself, and it's really fun to play with that because you find out what your evaluations are and how you communicate in terms of evaluations.
So give us the second one. We've only got probably a couple of minutes. And the second step?
Second step is feeling. So what are your feelings when the observation happened? How did you feel about it?
You know, Melanie, we're running out of time. I mistimed this. I'm going to have you back.
Those
four steps, and you can get them, I'm sure, from your book, Humanizing Healthcare, right?
Yes, and you can go to the website, CNBC.org, Center for Nonviolent Communication.org also.
And get them there. Thanks for being on the show. Melanie, I want to have you back again soon. Melanie Sears, giving us information that we all need and can use, the whole world can use. Thank you so much.
Thank you.